Chapter 7. Not even high intelligence and a sensitive spirit are of any help once the facts of a situation are deduced from a political theory and not vice versa. Robert Conquest. Since, as a consequence of the war called necessary to overthrow Hitler's despotism, another despotism was raised to a higher pitch of power, how can it be argued conclusively with reference to the inescapable facts that the end justified the means employed to involve the United States in that war? Charles A. Beard. About Harry Hopkins. I've thought long and hard about whether it is plausible to make this one man into the linchpin of an epoch, particularly given the permanent strategic infrastructure set in place by Soviet agents Harry Dexter White and Alger Hiss, not to mention the various accomplishments of hundreds more Soviet agents, not to mention the lasting impact of their willing, able, and unaffiliated, and even unconscious, accomplices. I've decided Hopkins merits special consideration due to his unique slot at the very pinnacle of the U.S. government inside the White House, inside the White House family quarters, in fact. There, for 3 years and 7 months, he was practically roommates with Roosevelt. Just what does Harry Hopkins do is a constant question in Washington, the New York Times wrote in July 1942. Whatever it was, the paper noted, officials commonly say that a project of national or international importance has not been finally approved by remarking, I haven't seen an HH on it. An HH on it, not an HLH on it? I wish I could bend time to get this tidbit back to Major George Racy Jordan just for the anecdotal support. Jordan was grilled to a carbon crisp over his recollection of the note he said he came across in one of those black suitcases and attributed to Harry Hopkins. He recalled it as having been signed H.H., not H.L.H., as cronies, including Hopkins' paper's editor Sidney Hyman, later swore Hopkins always signed off with when using initials. Not that they would have accepted the rest of Jordan's story, even the fully corroborated parts, if he'd recalled the complete monogram. For the record, House investigators found memos signed H.L.H., Harry, and Harry L. Hopkins. But the only H.H. the investigators came across was in a memo from Roosevelt to Hopkins. That said, investigators were denied permission to review Lend-Lease and other files in the Archives and State Department. My own research, however, turned up an original letter from Hopkins to one of Churchill's ministers, signed H.H. The point of the 1942 Times story was there was a time in Washington when the execution of American power required Harry Hopkins' stamp of approval. Without it, the record compellingly demonstrates, some of the best-laid plans of Moscow would never have come to pass. How can I say such a thing? Remember George C. Marshall's shocking statement to his biographer in 1957. Hopkins' job with the president was to represent the Russian interests. My job was to represent the American interests. Whether controlling the pace and flow of negotiations in Moscow from Washington, Hopkins' memo to Stettinius. I would like to be in direct touch with Harriman and the mission to Moscow, and any replies to Harriman's telegrams I would like to have sent through me and signed by me. Will you please notify everybody over there about this, so there will be no possible hitch about it? Blocking strategic communications to FDR, as when he openly discussed withholding cables from Winston Churchill and the U.S. ambassador in London, lest they persuade FDR to offer air support to anti-Nazi, anti-Soviet Poles during the Warsaw Uprising in September 1944, or assiduously inserting Stalin's strategic imperatives deep into U.S. policy, as with his furious lobbying for Stalin's second front in France, again contra Churchill. Hopkins made the Russian interest the American interest. There is a reason, there is a record, that explains why Spymaster Akhmerov, as Gordievsky recalled, considered Hopkins above Hiss, White, Curry, and the rest, the most important of all Soviet wartime agents in the United States. Without this one unlikely human hotspot of Kremlin influence, without this sickly man who alternately haunted death's door and high life's watering holes until finally succumbing in January 1946, without his artful domination of the 32nd president, without his lockstep loyal network of intra-governmental assistance he assembled to bypass constitutional checks and balances, World War II, the war that remade the world even as we know it today, would have taken an unrecognizably different course. In military terms, which are also human terms, the fighting would have likely ended much, much sooner, and much, much better from the American point of view, not the Soviet point of view. In political terms, which are also human terms, a shorter war would have prevented the Soviet enslavement of half of Europe and beyond, which occurred, in part, due to the relative positions of Allied armies in Europe in May 1945. In human terms, a shorter war would have meant millions fewer casualties, from the Nazi death houses to the battlefields. Indeed, a shorter war would also have spared Central Europe's urban centers, which were flattened by Allied firebombing campaigns, mainly in that final year of war, and particularly in those final months of fighting. The ultimate firebombing attack came at Dresden, where roughly 1,000 British and U.S. heavy bombers dropped roughly 4,000 tons of explosives and incendiary devices on the city center between February 13th and 15th, 1945, less than 3 months before VE Day on May 8, 1945. It is said, as the late historian John Keegan wrote, that this atrocious act was taken at the behest of Stalin. In the past, I've defended the firebombing of Dresden on the basis of the mission's stated objectives and the Nazis' refusal to surrender. But it is with a heavy heart that I now believe it was necessary only to facilitate Soviet territorial gain. On an extremely low level, defending Dresden makes me just another dupe of the great communist con. Was obliterating Dresden and some 30,000 of its residents to expedite the Soviet march on Berlin in America's best interest? Of course not. It wasn't in humanity's best interest either. Ironically, it was in the best interest of Dresden residents Victor and Eva Klemperer, who, having received Nazi orders to report for labor duty on the day before the firebombing campaign would begin, were able to escape near certain death by the light of these raging flames of destruction. Then again, if the war had been shorter, it all would have been unnecessary. The duration and outcome of the war itself, then, become a potential case against Harry Hopkins as the bayonet point of Soviet influence penetrating the White House. With a shorter war, it seems unlikely the Soviet Union would have emerged as a superpower, certainly not a territorial behemoth with a new empire. This hypothesis makes Hopkins the most overlooked catalyst of the 20th century. History may remember him as a bit player, but it's time to refocus posterity's attention. At first glance, of course, our sight line is short, blocked by those shelves of history books that, incredibly, gloss over Hopkins' controversial role. It is incredible, seemingly a virtuoso feat of misdirection, worthy of a master magician. But how did it happen? The very day after Hopkins' death in 1946, The Los Angeles Times editorial page took the occasion to score Hopkins' unelected powers and globetrotting machinations for being out of bounds by any constitutional concept, and urge the American people to ensure that a Harry Hopkins in the White House does not recur. At that moment, who would have imagined that a Harry Hopkins in the White House would, for most intents and purposes, be forgotten? In light of Hopkins' posthumous disappearing act, it's not surprising to learn that FDR prized the skinny, bluff man for his discretion, as The New Yorker reported in a gushing, two-part 1943 profile. "He knows I keep my mouth shut," Hopkins said. Hopkins didn't much function in public, didn't go to an office even, doing most of his work from a card table in his White House office bedroom, his bed littered with papers, notes, memorandums, and pamphlets, as we learn in Admiral William H. Standley's 1955 memoir, Admiral Ambassador to Russia. Standley was recounting a typically curious audience with Hopkins in December 1942, in which Standley sought to receive assurances that orders already approved by the president himself would go through to place Hopkins' lend-lease man in Moscow, General Philip Feynmanville, under Standley's authority. Which is what I meant earlier when I said there was a time in Washington when the execution of American power, including presidential power, required Harry Hopkins' approval. Funny thing about Feynmanville, who, at least until his Hopkins-secured promotion to general, was known as the pro-Soviet Red Colonel. Army intelligence had tagged him a serious security risk, even arranging his recall from Moscow in 1939, after which Roosevelt reacted by publicly receiving Feynmanville at the White House and going on a private fishing trip with him, as historian Dennis J. Dunn writes, which in itself is curious. Hopkins muscled Feynmanville back into place over both War Department and State Department objections to become the administrator of Lend-Lease in Moscow in 1941. "You might as well get his papers ready," Hopkins bluntly told the Army, "because he's going over," as indeed he did. We now know the intelligence against Feynmanville was right all along. He wasn't just a security risk. He was a security disaster. Rommerstein and Brindell discovered that in 1942, the NKVD developed Feynmanville, Soviet lingo for recruited, through an agent who acted as Feynmanville's male lover. Standley, also in 1942, was rightfully suspicious of Feynmanville, whom he regarded as a conduit of U.S. military information to the Soviets. The ambassador wanted him restricted. That's what Standley told Roosevelt over lunch with him and Hopkins on trays in the president's private study. Standley describes Hopkins eating from a plate in his lap, relaxed against the cushions as if deathly tired. Roosevelt agreed to Standley's request, but nothing happened. That is, no orders were issued. So Standley went to see Hopkins at his card table command post in the Lincoln bedroom. "Hello, Admiral," he said, waving me to a seat without rising. "I've never seen a man look so sick and still keep producing. And yet," I reflected, "he has more power in the United States than anyone but the president, and probably more influence and real power among the Western allies than anyone but the president and Winston Churchill." "How are you, Harry?" I said as I seated myself. He ignored the question. "When are you returning to Moscow, Admiral?" "That depends on you, Harry." "How's that?" I grinned ruefully. "The president directed that orders be issued to General Feynmanville to report to me for duty. I have been informed by Mr. Stettinius that you are the only person in Washington who can issue those orders. When those orders have been issued, I will leave for Moscow." Harry leaned back and closed his eyes for a moment. See Jim Burns tomorrow, Admiral. It will be arranged. Whatever was arranged didn't much change the chain of command in Moscow, where the Lend-Lease bureaucracy, as Dennis J. Dunn explains in Caught Between Roosevelt and Stalin, his indispensable study of the first five American ambassadors to Soviet Russia, functioned as State Department, the War Department, and the ambassador and embassy in Moscow. The Hopkins shop was a government within a government, or an engine room within the ship of state, as piloted by this very strange captain. His influence was boundless. Notes scribbled across a presidential cable in 1941, for example, tell us it was Hopkins who urged that the president should personally deal with Stalin after Hopkins' initial and, intriguingly, private meeting with Stalin, sans U.S. ambassador or any other American witness, in July 1941. Was it Hopkins who fed FDR the line that he, FDR, and only he, could deal with Stalin the man, as FDR unctuously and famously imparted it to Churchill? Hopkins also jotted down, matter-of-fact, imperiously, the following. After he spent the afternoon with Stimson and Marshall, the Secretary of War and the Army Chief of Staff, Stimson is obviously unhappy because he is not consulted about the strategy of the war, and I think he feels I could be more helpful in relating him and Marshall to the president. The linchpin in action. Hopkins left behind voluminous files, which his personal assistant, Sidney Hyman, spent 8 months putting into order before official biographer Robert Sherwood even arrived on the scene, swooping in from Hollywood, where he'd just finished the Academy Award-winning screenplay of The Best Years of Our Lives. It was these papers, as put in order by Hyman, that Sherwood drew from for the 971-page Hopkins biography, a work with unusual authority, one realizes, on seeing it referenced as a primary source in State Department records of the historic wartime conferences between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. I underscore Hyman's stewardship of the papers because it makes me nervous. The reason goes back to the Hopkins uranium story, as experienced and boldly recounted by Major George Racy Jordan, for whose nearly unique witness of Hopkins committing treason on Moscow's behalf, we should be eternally grateful. Hyman was a loud voice in the echo chamber attacking Jordan's testimony under oath before Congress, in which Jordan, as we saw in Chapter 5, declared that Harry Hopkins had, in 1943, ordered him to expedite a shipment of ultra-sensitive uranium to Moscow, off the books and on the QT. The Hyman tack was to insist that Hopkins, who died in 1946, couldn't have so ordered Jordan in 1943 because Hopkins didn't even know what uranium was at that time and, further, didn't know about the Manhattan Project until after Hiroshima in 1945. It was Newsweek that reported Hyman's response to Jordan's testimony in December 1949. Moreover, according to Sidney Hyman, FDR's confidant didn't have the faintest understanding of the Manhattan Project until he read about the A-bomb being dropped on Hiroshima. Hyman said, he didn't know the difference between uranium and geranium. It wasn't until weeks later that Hopkins talked with several of the atomic scientists and learned about the engineering feat of production. Hopkins didn't know the difference between uranium and geranium? I am burning up on that, Jordan told Congress in March 1950, 3 months after his first appearance. Jordan went on to cite the relevant passages as published in the Hyman-aided Sherwood biography of Hopkins, which lay out Hopkins' extremely intimate awareness of and central involvement in setting up and monitoring what became known as the Manhattan Project, awareness and involvement that also predated FDR's. According to the Sherwood biography, It was Vannevar Bush, the atomic project's overseeing scientist, who made Hopkins the intermediary between himself and Roosevelt. And it was Hopkins who helped Bush draft the letter initiating the research project for Roosevelt's signature on June 15, 1940. Later, Churchill would conduct his correspondence on the atomic project with Hopkins rather than with the president. Sherwood notes, adding elsewhere, Hopkins never lost his interest in the fission of uranium. Based on the record assembled by Hyman himself for Sherwood, we must conclude that Hopkins did indeed very much know the difference between uranium and geranium, knowledge that wasn't in any way controversial, until Jordan, stubborn witness, popped up to report on what he knew of Hopkins' role in shipping that uranium to the Soviet Union during the time of the USSR's massive espionage plot, codenamed Enormous, to beg, borrow, and steal U.S. atomic technology as fast as it was being secretly invented. Additionally, when this same massive espionage plot first came under FBI surveillance, Hopkins warned the Soviets, as I will explain below. Why would Hyman lie in 1949 when the truth was published in the 1948 bestseller he himself helped prepare? My best guess is desperation. Jordan's bombshell that co-president Hopkins was potentially involved in the Soviet atomic operation couldn't be allowed to develop into a respectable line of inquiry without turning into a press sensation that would crack open the Roosevelt White House. Hyman thus participated in the creation of another big lie, that surefire mechanism of thought control, which, as Conquest tells us, was originated by Stalin. Throw enough body blows at Jordan, uranium, geranium, a column by Drew Pearson seeding suspicion about Jordan's motives, a blatantly grotesque snapshot of Jordan in Life magazine. The photo editor should have been ashamed. And Jordan goes down for the count, leaving Hopkins, the real perp, to readjust his hat, smooth his lapels, and walk on, posthumously speaking, absolved of all explosive charges. Thus, he could also be forgotten, because who really needs to remember a man who didn't know uranium from geranium? Hopkins himself sometimes lamented the backstairs stealth of his career. In the August 1943 New Yorker profile, the magazine noted that Hopkins was sometimes depressed by the thought that some of the history of this period will probably never be known to the public. No one will ever know how smart I was? This makes for an intriguing flicker of personal regret coming from someone whom official biographer Sherwood would document as a highly secretive person from childhood. "I can't ever make Harry out," his mother said. "He never tells me what he's really thinking." This isn't necessarily exceptional human behavior, but it would fit Hopkins' lifelong pattern. In meetings, he was notorious for arguing all sides of an argument without letting on which one he favored, a technique dependent on a high degree of sang-froid. Sherwood also relates a particularly apt story from Hopkins' college days at Grinnell, where, by the way, this son of an Iowa harness maker was known as Dirty Harry for low-down moves on the basketball court. As a senior at Grinnell, Hopkins was approached by sophomore leaders for advice on strategy and tactics in the annual sophomore-freshman class battle. He gave it freely. Then he was approached, quite independently, by freshman leaders for advice. He gave that freely too, telling the freshmen how to counter possible sophomore strategy, which he, of course, had suggested. Neither side knew that Hopkins had masterminded both sides. Given Hopkins' White House role in influencing and shaping sophomore or U.S. strategy on behalf of the freshmen or the Soviets, and also deviously sharing that sophomore strategy with the freshmen or the Soviets, the parallels are uncanny, his early penchant for double agenting chilling. We know this also from another Soviet source, the Matrokhin Archive, which tells us that earlier in the year, he had privately warned the Soviet embassy in Washington that the FBI had bugged a secret meeting at which Zarubin, apparently identified by Hopkins only as a member of the embassy, had passed money to Steve Nelson, a leading member of the U.S. Communist underground. Let's leave aside the unsubstantiated parenthetical comment preemptively declaring Hopkins apparently guileless. We have just learned that Hopkins blew an ongoing FBI surveillance operation by revealing to the Soviet embassy that a Soviet official had been bugged delivering money to the American Communist underground. Never mind that this Soviet chain of activity was in flagrant violation of the 1933 terms of U.S. diplomatic recognition, prohibiting espionage activities in this country. The footnote to the statement cites Matrokin's Archive, Volume 6, Chapter 12, and further notes. Hopkins had been personally briefed by Hoover on Zarubin's visit to Nelson. Hoover would doubtless have been outraged had he known that Hopkins had informed the Soviet embassy. With good cause. Hoover's briefing came in the form of a personal and confidential letter to Hopkins, which the authors cite from Benson and Warner's book Venona, where it is reproduced in full. To unpack Andrew and Matrokin's statement and really shake out the wrinkles, we need to know first that Vasily Zarubin, who used the cover name Vasily Zubilin, that'll throw people off, was a Soviet Comintern agent, later identified as the top NKVD resident in the United States. We need to know also that Hopkins knew that Zarubin was a Soviet Comintern agent, despite Andrew and Matrokin's parenthetical testament to Hopkins' apparent ignorance. We know Hopkins knew this because J. Edgar Hoover, in the very letter Andrew and Matrokin cite, told Hopkins so. Dear Harry, Hoover wrote in a letter marked Personal and Confidential, stamped May 7, 1943, some weeks after George Racy Jordan claims to have gotten orders from Hopkins to expedite a uranium shipment to Moscow. Through a highly confidential and reliable source, it has been determined that on April 10, 1943, a Russian who is an agent of the Communist International paid a sum of money to Steve Nelson, National Committee Man of the Communist Party USA, at the latter's home in Oakland, California. The money was reportedly paid to Nelson for the purpose of placing Communist Party members and Comintern agents in industry engaged in secret war production for the United States government so that information could be obtained for transmittal to the Soviet Union. The Russian agent of the Communist International has been identified as Vasily Zubilin, third secretary of the Embassy of the USSR. New York City is his headquarters. Both Nelson and Zubilin will meet in the near future with other leaders of the Communist International, or Comintern, apparatus active in the United States. The letter continues on to the next page. Steps are being taken by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to identify all members of the Communist International or Comintern apparatus with which Steve Nelson and Vasily Zubilin are connected, as well as the agents of that apparatus in various war industries. Because of the relationship demonstrated in this investigation between the Communist Party USA, the Communist International, and the Soviet government, I thought the President and you would be interested in these data. These matters are being brought to your attention at this time for your confidential information, inasmuch as the investigation is continuing. Sincerely yours, Edgar. Zarubin Zubilin was the top Soviet intelligence officer in the United States, who, we would later find out, supervised Soviet atomic espionage. In fact, it was from this bugging of Nelson's home in Oakland, California, that the FBI learned about both the existence of the super-secret Manhattan Project and the Soviet espionage operation targeting it for the very first time. Hopkins' reaction to Hoover's revelation may be the most damning piece of evidence of all in the case against Harry Hopkins. When we read what Hoover told Hopkins in his confidential letter, that a Comintern agent, posing as a senior Soviet diplomat in the United States, was passing money to the American Communist underground to establish Comintern networks within the U.S. war industry to steal military secrets, and see Hopkins immediately turn around and tell the Soviet embassy that the FBI was onto them, we have to realize we are looking at a traitor acting with Soviet, not American interests at heart. I don't see any other plausible conclusion. And this traitor was the closest advisor of the President of the United States. I must interject one additional detail that Romerstein and Brindell provide in their report on the Zerubin-Nelson link, as recorded by a young FBI agent named William Brannigan, who would go on to head the FBI's Soviet counterintelligence section. In the course of their conversation, Zerubin and Nelson also discussed the work of Gregory Kafitz, NKVD San Francisco resident, and his mistress, Louise Branson, a wealthy California communist who hosted parties bringing agents together at her San Francisco home. Kafitz was the agent assigned by Moscow to raid UC Berkeley's radiation laboratory where work on the atomic bomb was being done. George Racy Jordan mentioned Kafitz in his 1950 testimony on the shipment of atomic materials, the cadmium rods, heavy water, uranium, and other atomic pile ingredients that went through the Lend-Lease hub under his supervision in Great Falls, Montana. Discussing a young Soviet sergeant, Jordan believed was, in fact, a KGB minder sent to Great Falls to watch over the Soviet Lend-Lease chief at the base, Colonel Kotikov. Jordan mentioned that this particular sergeant took a lot of mysterious trips for a junior NCO. Where would he go? When he would apply to go to San Francisco, he would go to see Gregory Kafitz, Jordan recalled. This detail may not connect another dot, but it does add a dot to enlarge the plane on which the Soviet conspiracy was taking place. As Kotikov was collecting the ingredients in his bomb chemicals folder, his minder was tripping off to San Francisco to see a senior NKVD officer overseeing atomic espionage in the United States. From Jordan, we have testimony that Harry Hopkins telephoned to push uranium through Great Falls to Moscow in April 1943. From Matrokin's KGB archive, we know that Hopkins tipped off the Soviets to the FBI's April 1943 surveillance of atomic espionage in San Francisco. From J. Edgar Hoover's May 1943 letter, we know that Hopkins knew, at the very least, that he was tipping off the Soviets to FBI surveillance of a known Soviet agent seeking U.S. military secrets. In light of what Hopkins did upon receiving the Hoover letter, I don't see how Hopkins can conceivably be described as anything but a conscious and conscientious agent of the Soviet Union. It's worth underscoring that the Hoover letter goes on to note the existence of further evidence of cooperation between the CPUSA and the Comintern in such penetration operations, to offer details on Nelson's background, and to caution Hopkins about the confidential nature of the information inasmuch as the investigation is continuing. Summing up, Hoover wrote, because of the relationship demonstrated in this investigation between the Communist Party, USA, the Communist International, and the Soviet government, I thought the President and you would be interested in these data. The President and you. It wasn't just Berbalane magazine copy that promoted the Roosevelt-Hopkins co-presidency. It was for real. Sure enough, Hopkins was so very interested in Hoover's data that he couldn't wait to tell the Soviets. Did he ever even tell Roosevelt? We don't know. Somehow I doubt it. The net effect of Hopkins spilling the FBI's beans to the Soviets, then, was to make the Soviets, the freshmen, more discreet in the future, more mindful of FBI eyes and ears. Just think, we wouldn't know about this act of treason if a retired KGB archivist named Matrokin hadn't bothered to copy, hide, and successfully smuggle his archives out of the former Soviet Union in 1992. Hopkins' guilt on this particularly damning count would have remained secret, probably forever. Still, clues to Hopkins' Soviet allegiance were always in plain sight, however unremarkable they might sometimes have appeared amid the rosy red outlook of the day. Despite the pro-Soviet mood, however, it's hard to imagine even a casual New Yorker reader, diverted by single malt scotch ads and Broadway reviews, failing to pick up on Hopkins' abnormal partiality to communist Russia on scanning his 1943 profile. It was a leading attribute. The New Yorker called him, next to Roosevelt, the country's first really influential appreciator of American friendship with Soviet Russia, described him as an articulate propagandist for all-out aid to Russia, noted that Hopkins still thinks the Russian front is the most important one, and quoted him as saying, "I had the Russian story for the president. The political implications of extending lend-lease to Russia have never bothered me, and I carried that Soviet banner around town. Marshall is fine with it." Circa 1943, everybody, practically, was fine with it, or kept his mouth shut for fear of being labeled a dread isolationist, or worse, pro-Hitler. The only enemy in the world was Adolf Hitler and his ideology Nazism, the U.S. government line went. Japan, too, but that was practically an afterthought. From Hollywood to Times Square, we heard that Stalin and his ideology communism were A-OK, and that nothing short of alliance with him could vanquish the Nazis anyway. Just for fun, invert reality and try this. Hopkins was, next to Roosevelt, the country's first really influential appreciator of Nazi Germany. He was an articulate propagandist for all-out aid to Hitler, and he said, "I carried that Nazi banner around town. Marshall is fine with it." The notion that the president's top advisor was pro-Nazi triggers revulsion, as of course it should. But why was it all right for him to carry the Soviet, tear, blood, and sweat-drenched banner, which flew over the world's original concentration camps, the revival of execution without trial, state hostage-taking, the eradication of political parties, and more inhumanities? Why was it so easy to distract Americans with deceitful rhetoric, slick pictorials, and ironic cartoons? Anything to defeat the Nazi beast, even supporting another, already demonstrably worse, body count to body count, communist beast? When his New Yorker profile appeared, Hopkins had been living with what the magazine called dressing gown run of Roosevelt's floor in the White House, for over 3 years. The previous summer, Hopkins had gotten married in the president's second-floor oval study, immediately moving his bride into his executive mansion digs. As a couple, the Hopkins dined with the president or Mrs. Roosevelt, or both, about 5 nights a week. Much more than a permanent house guest with special perks. The Hopkinses get setups for drinks by calling the White House pantry. Hopkins was frenetically busy wielding formidable governmental, even presidential, war powers. Example, as chairman of the Munitions Assignment Board, Hopkins presides over a group of British and American generals and admirals, the New Yorker wrote, describing a role that sounds decidedly commander-in-chiefish. This particular group, which met once a week during the war, determined which allies received what American munitions, how many bombers should go to the USSR, for example. Hopkins, meanwhile, continued to supervise his hand-picked Lend-Lease staff at home and abroad. Did I mention Hopkins was also chairman of something called the President's Soviet Protocol Committee? This panel, as described by the New Yorker, was set up to assess adequate treatment of Soviet requests. In other words, to ram them through. As the Soviet Protocol Committee minutes of November 26, 1942 tell us, it worked like this. The decision to act, in other words, supply the Soviets, without full information was made with some misgivings, but after due deliberation, Mr. Hopkins said that there was no reservation about the policy at the present time, but that the policy was constantly being brought up for rediscussion. He proposed that no further consideration be given to these requests for rediscussion. How Politburo-like. What did Roosevelt think about all of this? Coming to this project, let's say, as a citizen historian, trying to understand why history hasn't been adding up, I have been relieved to encounter continual reference to the inscrutability of FDR, even from close associates. In other words, it wasn't just unfamiliarity with the material that makes Roosevelt difficult to understand. He was difficult to understand. He liked stamps and sea stories and took a childlike delight in such things as having two neighbors from Southern Dutchess County in his cabinet, Morgenthau and Forrestal. This was the simple side of the man, which either masked the sage or revealed the lightweight. Meanwhile, Roosevelt was always the steely politician, the man who brought forth on this continent a new collection of special interest groups, surely leading us away from political Eden by ignoring Madison's warning about factions in Federalist 10. This was the Machiavellian side of the man, which was above all power-driven. Unexpectedly, he appears also to have been largely non-ideological, unprincipled, said his detractors. This may seem like a paradox, given that FDR presided over the ideological transformation of the Democratic Party, which, pre-New Deal, was, like the GOP, more identified with traditions and personalities than with a specific and entrenched doctrine. As Dean of the Washington Newsman Arthur Kroc saw it, Roosevelt didn't have much political philosophy, but ideology became a means to an end. Also, according to Kroc, it was under Harry Hopkins' tutelage that FDR came to regard the New Deal political alliance of labor and farmers as the golden key to perpetuity of power, which proved to be true. There was, however, one point of ideology that Roosevelt does seem to have fervently embraced, which historian Dennis J. Dunn believes made him an ideologue after all. FDR, Dunn writes, seized on the theory of convergence as it applied to the United States and the USSR, the idea being that capitalism and communism would take on enough characteristics of the other to converge. Sounds very Zen in 1970s, but no. Convergence theory powered all manner of trade, social, scientific, and political byplay between the United States and the USSR from the start of relations up to and including that Nixon-Kissinger relic, détente. Further, in their memoirs, sources as disparate as Roosevelt Bete Noire, Representative Martin Dies, and Roosevelt ally, Cardinal Spellman, describe separate private conversations with FDR in which the president expanded on the concept in 1940 and 1943, respectively. Similarly, Averill Harriman underscored its importance in Roosevelt's thinking, as did Sumner Welles. Roosevelt's belief in convergence makes perfect sense. After all, the New Deal, in Martin Dye's apt formulation, the classic Communist Front organization, secretly directed by communists, expanded the powers and reach of the centralized state, becoming a gigantic, one-way convergence enterprise of its own. Not that we are taught to see it in such terms. As Dunn explains it, the convergence theory held that Soviet Russia and the United States were on convergent paths, where the United States was moving from laissez-faire capitalism to welfare state socialism, and the Soviet Union was evolving from totalitarianism to social democracy. Having himself moved the United States from laissez-faire capitalism to welfare state socialism, FDR knew he was at least half right, but being half right doesn't validate the whole theory. That is, there's no convergence if only one side is doing all the converging. That's capitulation, and, going forward, appeasement. With the fervor of the true believer, the president set his political progress accordingly, and the nation's. Dunn argues that it was this overriding belief in a common point of convergence that allowed Roosevelt to discount and overlook all violently contradictory evidence between here and there. In other words, the purely theoretical end justifies the concretely brutal means. Such means included millions killed and jailed to secure the Soviet regime at home, millions jailed and killed to secure the Soviet regime abroad, and every big lie, act of police state repression and flame of fear and terror generated in between. Not only did FDR overlook the external evidence, FDR ignored the counsel of key experts at the State Department, which, at the time, was home, mirabile dictu, to an educated and experienced cadre of anti-communists, or better, communist realists, yesteryear's Islamophobes, who would be neutralized and dispersed, in other words, purged, in two waves. The first wave was in 1937, when even the Russian research library at the State Department was broken up, the files on communists, foreign and domestic, ordered destroyed. The second wave was in 1943. Both purges took place under Soviet pressure and even direction, as when, in March 1943, Soviet Ambassador Litvinov, incredibly, handed over a list of American diplomats the Soviets wanted fired. This list included the scholarly anti-communist Loy Henderson, who would, as a direct result of Soviet pressure, be reposted to Iraq as a guilt offering to Stalin from Roosevelt, as Martin Weil speculates. How else to atone for an advisor who committed crime think multiple times? By arguing, among other things, not only that the democracies could survive a Nazi conquest of the USSR, but also that, if the world were ever lucky enough to see the communist tyranny fall, the United States should not recognize a Soviet government in exile. Of course, the United States never presented the Soviet government with a similar list of grievances about Politburo hardliners who were antagonistic toward the United States. What vassal state would dare? This question follows from earlier arguments that the vast and deep extent of communist penetration, heretofore denied, had in fact reached a tipping point to become a de facto communist occupation of the American center of power. Reading about the abrupt disappearance of tens of thousands of anti-subversive files from the Office of Naval Intelligence in 1944, and the wreckage of thousands of Army G2 counterintelligence records in a campaign of dismemberment in 1943 to 1944, at the behest of Harry Hopkins, by the way, and the Secret Service, Army officials told the FBI, brings to mind a new order, sweeping in to clean out the old. Indeed, under Roosevelt, the United States engaged in certain behaviors that we may recognize as those of the supplicant nation, driven by undue concern, even fear, of annoying or angering its patron. An unnatural solicitude for an empire that was evil, long before any American president dared mention it, led the United States down a path of unreturned concession and unredeemable appeasement. Something else, too, was set in motion when the United States recognized the Soviet Union on November 16, 1933, 8 months after Gareth Jones, then Malcolm Muggeridge, were smacked down for reporting to the wider world the facts of the terror famine. Something else that came into the world as recognition was toasted with quaffs of what was almost the last of Prohibition beer in the wee hours of November 17th. When Franklin Roosevelt finally extended normal diplomatic relations in exchange for a page of Soviet concessions signed by Foreign Minister Maxim Litvinov, who, Prohibition beer on his breath, then returned to the still unofficial Soviet outpost in the USA, all smiles and said, "Well, it's in the bag, we have it." The U.S. government found itself derailed onto a strange new track through an unfamiliar, soon monotonous land of endless apologetics. The crux of the U.S.-USSR agreement rested on a series of promises accepted and signed by Litvinov that listed, very specifically, what the Soviet Union would not do in the United States, its territories, or possessions. Namely, it would not attempt to subvert or overthrow the U.S. system. The declaration scrupulously stated the USSR would refrain and restrain all persons and all organizations under its direct or indirect control from taking any act, overt or covert, aimed at the overthrow or preparation for the overthrow of the United States. It further specifically stipulated that the Soviet government would not form or support groups inside the United States, such as the Soviet-supported CPUSA and myriad front groups, such as the Soviet-directed underground espionage networks Bentley and Chambers later broke with, such as the CPUSA Comintern group on the West Coast that Harry Hopkins found out Hoover was bugging and knowingly told the Soviets. The agreement, in other words, was a bunch of lies. The first bunch of lies of many. To make it all stick, however, to keep this sorriest of bad bargains, to perpetuate the myth of U.S.-Soviet accord, the United States had to pretend otherwise. The United States had to retire to a new fantasy world of its own creation, in which the Soviet Union was keeping its word, in which Soviet-directed and financed espionage did not exist, in which communists were not under every bed, in which even the act of looking was red-baiting, and anti-communists were paranoid about bugaboos. As our most respected and beloved leaders increasingly sought refuge in this world of pretend, they led the nation on a disastrous retreat from reality from which we have never, ever returned. In our retreat, we left morality behind, undefended. Now, as far as we know, Harry Hopkins had nothing to do at this beginning. Then again, I have found that we don't know much about who did. 4 presidents and their 6 secretaries of state, for over a decade and a half, held to this resolve not to recognize the Soviet government, as Herbert Hoover, one of those 4 presidents, wrote in Freedom Betrayed, his posthumously published History of World War II, published in 2011. These American leaders understood that the Bolsheviks' seizure of the government by force, their rain of blood, their pledge to conspire against other governments, made the mutual confidence required for diplomatic relations impossible. However, Hoover doesn't explain the shift in thinking. Indeed, who or what specifically inspired FDR to undertake this momentous decision is largely glossed over in the historical narrative in general. Although we do know Soviet recognition was applauded by businessmen eager to sell their rope to Lenin. The interchanges that followed, the relations that evolved, were marked and warped by paradoxes we would later understand and explain as Orwellian. Some of them, Alexander Solzhenitsyn would bring to our attention some 40 years later. In his very first speech on his very first trip to the USA in 1975, the 56-year-old Solzhenitsyn asked the question he had wanted to ask America most of his adult life. He set it up by comparing America's historic aversion to alliance with Tsarist Russia to Roosevelt's rush to recognize a far more repressive and infinitely more violent Bolshevik Russia in 1933. Pre-revolutionary executions by the Tsarist government came to about 17 per year, Solzhenitsyn said, while, as a point of comparison, the Spanish Inquisition at its height destroyed 10 persons per month. In the revolutionary years of 1918 and 1919, he continued, the Cheka executed without trial, more than 1,000 per month. At the height of Stalin's terror in 1937 and 1938, tens of thousands of people were shot per month. The author of the Gulag Archipelago put it all together like so. Here are the figures. 17 a year, 10 a month, more than 1,000 a month, more than 40,000 a month. Thus, that which had made it difficult for the democratic West to form an alliance with pre-revolutionary Russia had, by 1941, grown to such an extent, yet still did not prevent the entire United Democracies of the world, England, France, the United States, Canada, and other small countries, from entering into a military alliance with the Soviet Union. How is this to be explained? How can we understand it? Presidents Wilson, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover all rejected relations with the Bolshevik regime. This would seem to mark these men as belonging to the earlier era of Albert Dreyfus, when, as Robert Conquest notes, the conscience of the civilized world could be aroused by the false condemnation to imprisonment of a single French captain for a crime which had actually been committed, though not by him. A generation or two later, the conscience of the civilized world couldn't be aroused, period. Not by the false condemnation of one, nor the false condemnation of thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands, as Conquest explains. The Soviet equivalent of the Dreyfus case involved the execution of thousands of officers, from marshals and admirals down, on charges which were totally imaginary. What happened to the conscience of the civilized world? The West's decision to recognize the USSR, and its determination to keep recognizing it, no matter how much lying and acquiescence to betrayal that entailed, did more to transform us than any single act before or since. The profound diplomatic shift, part Faustian bargain, part moral lobotomy, didn't just invite the Soviet Union into the community of nations. To make room for the monster regime, the United States had to surrender the terra firma of objective morality and reality-based judgment. No wonder, then, that tens of thousands of Dreyfus cases in Russia meant nothing to the conscience of the civilized world. Implications had already been officially sundered from facts. To be sure, there was something new in the way recognition, ever after, reordered the priorities and actions of our republic, something that marked the beginning of a different kind of era. The fact is, the implications of normalizing relations with the thoroughly abnormal USSR didn't just reward and legitimize a regime of rampantly metastasizing criminality. Because the communist regime was so openly and ideologically dedicated to our destruction, the act of recognition defied reason and the demands of self-preservation. recognition and all that came with it, including alliance, would soon become the enemy of reason and self-preservation. In this way, as Dennis J. Dunn points out, we see a double standard in American foreign policy evolve, and, I would add, in American thinking more generally. It was here that we abandoned the lodestars of good and evil, the clarity of black and white. Closing our eyes, we dove headfirst into a weltering morass of exquisitely enervating and agonizing grays. This is the journey that forced open our psyches to increasingly expansive experiments in moral relativism. Only a very few refused to go. Only a very few saw the sin. There is something poignantly allegorical in Solzhenitsyn's recollection of being a young Red Army soldier flummoxed by what he and his comrades heard as Roosevelt's disastrous misreading of Stalin at around the time of the Tehran Conference. As they marched on the Elbe, he said, they hoped to meet the Americans and tell them. He added, just before that happened, I was taken off to prison and my meeting didn't take place. Just before that happened, just before he was going to tell his American compatriots the truth about Stalin, about the Soviet Union, the 26-year-old was arrested by the NKVD for the most mildly derogatory statements about Stalin written in a letter. He was sentenced to a labor camp for 8 years. Solzhenitsyn would have been too late anyway. Having abandoned the Western moral tradition and Enlightenment logic as a precondition of the U.S.-USSR relationship, we already inhabited a brave new and dangerous realm. Wishful thinking was in. Evidence was out. Ideology was in. Facts were out. With an exchange of rustling paper at the White House, the revolution was here, the epicenter of American betrayal.